Welcome to Booked, the game that rummages through literature's costume and props department before settling to the green room with long theatrical anecdotes. And here's a little poem that describe our panel. Here come the panel like children at a party. Here come the panel like convicts on the run. Here come the panel, faces pale and arty. Too much reading, not enough sun. Trying on the wigs and tanning the corsets of the regulars Miles Kington and Dewey Keane. Whilst tying up the brogues and powdering their hair are Mark Thomas and Roger McGough. So now we've dressed ourselves up and dusted ourselves down, let's tiptoe to the stage door and begin the first round, Literary Doctors and Nurses. Each panellist will find a pack of cards in front of them. Each card has written upon it the name of a literary doctor or nurse. All you have to do is describe what's on the card so the others guess it. You can only pass on one, and you've only got a minute, and I'm going to be very tough. Dillian Miles, off you go.
Oh, science fiction, Dr.
Strangelove.
No, Dr. Question mark.
Who? He made a monster.
Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Casebook, had a casebook.
Finley. He had a television program, and he was American. He was Richard Chamberlain.
Kildare.
Yep.
Martin Chuzzlewit.
30 seconds.
She
had an umbrella named after him.
Gamp.
Right.
The Soul of Souls of the Devil.
Dr. Foster's.
Yep.
Oh, don't believe this. French novel by Flaubert.
Oh, Dr.
The husband.
Dr. Bovary.
Yes, I don't.
I do not love thee.
Dr. Fell.
Yep.
My God, Dr. Spike on a Rose.
5 seconds.
Dr. Spike on a Rose.
What's a Spike on a Rose called?
Thorn.
Very good.
Yeah. And from Treasure Island.
Time's up.
Thank God for that.
Dr. Livesey, of course.
Livesey, right. Who is Dr. Thorne? I've no idea. Trollope.
Dr. Thorne was a book by Trollope. Thought you knew that, Miles. Mark and Roger, off you go. You've only got a minute.
Mr. Hyde and
Dr. Jekyll. Mate of Sherlock Holmes.
Dr. Watson. Doctor with liked animals crawling all over
him. Doolittle.
Indeed.
Russian bloke.
Dr. Farrago.
Dr. Farrago?
That's Nurse Farrago.
That well-known feminist doctor.
Yeah, this can be either mortal or venial. Only what? Catholic. Only Catholic. An offence against God.
So Dr. Sin.
Dr. Sin. Dr. Sin.
This one went to Gloucester.
Dr. Foster again. This is the real. The real.
McCoy.
Dr. McCoy.
Oh, blimey.
15 seconds.
Pass.
This is...
Oh, no, I won't pass.
No.
Poet, bloke.
5 seconds.
Man. Dr. Larkin, Dr.
No,
Hughes.
It's John Keats.
Dr. John Keats.
Time.
Yes.
I cheated
time?
A little bit.
Time, I'm afraid.
That's it, time.
Time, minute.
I didn't know that John Keats was a doctor.
Chemist, I thought he was a
chemist. So let's move on. And now, beginnings and endings. We've asked our panellists to be very, very clever indeed and to come up with new beginnings and endings for well-known literary texts. Miles, you were given The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. This is the story of Dr. Jekyll, a physician who's aware of both good and evil in his personality. He discovers a drug that allows him to create a separate personality and manifest all his evil sides.
Oh, that's
so,
Dr. Jekyll.
That's the one. So let's hear your new beginnings and endings then, Miles.
The doctor's working late tonight. The words came from two Scottish passers-by one night late in 1803, as they looked up the lights burning late at the top of Dr. Jekyll's house in Edinburgh New Town. It was Saturday night in Edinburgh, and elsewhere in the capital, Hearts supporters would be burning down the humble dwellings of Hibs supporters, and Hibs fans would be setting fire to the humble abodes of Hearts supporters. But here in the New Town, there was no sport except sneering at the English behind their backs, and folk generally went to bed early, except Dr. Jekyll. The doctor's working late tonight, said the passerby. Aye, I heard you first time, said his companion. Then why did he say nothing? There was nothing to say. You didn't ask me a question. Well, I'm asking you a question anew. Oh, what is it? It's this. What do you suppose Dr. Jekyll's doing working so late? I hardly the faintest bloody idea, said the other passerby, and I couldn't care less either. And having served their purpose in this story in setting the scene and having exhausted the author's abilities to recreate the Scottish accent, the two passers-by passed on and out of the story. But if they had known, gentle reader, what Dr. Jekyll was doing so late at the top of the house, they might have shaken their heads and looked askance. For Dr. Jekyll was engaged in mixing together potions that many people should say should never be mixed together. On the table in front of him stood a bottle of orange liquid, which in the Scottish tongue is called iron brew. And another bottle full of lemonade, and other bottles full of cheap malt whiskey and Scottish ale and commercial alcohol. For yes, dear reader, Dr. Jekyll was engaged in trying to find a new drink, a combination that had never been found before, known only to the Scots nation. Now, said Dr. Jekyll half aloud, let's see what happens if we mix all of them together. The iron brew fizzed up briefly as it met the drambuie. Then the rest was added, and Dr. Jekyll drained it in one draught. For a moment he felt nothing, and then he felt his body begin to change. Hair began growing on his arms. A beard sprouted. A parrot appeared on his shoulder. One of his legs fell off. Ha! Said the doctor. That's good stuff. I'll have another of these, so I will, show me timbers. Well, that's the beginning, so the ending. I see Dr. Jekyll's working late tonight, said a passerby in Old Edinburgh. Not the same passerby as before, but it was so dark a night and Edinburgh's street lighting was so primitive that it would have been hard to tell whether it was the same man as before or no. I see Dr. Jekyll's working late tonight, he said again. No, he's not, said a rough voice. He's right behind you. The man spun round. There, not 5 feet away, stood the most horrifying sight he'd ever seen. It was a squat man in seafaring clothes with a parrot on one shoulder and only one leg and a crutch, an expression of the most leering ferocity. Ha-ha, said the apparition. Share my timbers, Jim lad. Ha-ha, piece of bait. Who are you? Said the man, half dead with fear. Sometimes I'm Dr. Jekyll, and sometimes I'm Long John McSilver, said the revolting apparition. I'm an old pirate, retired now, settled down to more land-loving trade. Body snatching! As the fearsome, one-legged man stepped forward, the passerby, instead of shrinking back, took out a gun from his pocket and coolly leveled it at the seafarer's head. Mr. John McSilver, I'm a police officer, and I'm arresting you on various charges, including body snatching, importing a parrot without going through quarantine, altering a grade one listed wooden leg without planning permission, putting a dead man in the chest, and many other things too numerous to mention.
You think you're very clever, Mr. Policeman, beamed the ex-pirate. You've forgotten one thing. At dawn, I turned back into a respectable doctor. Ha ha!
Don't worry, said the policeman. That moment will never come. You will already be shot dead for resisting arrest. And shot him.
Mark, we gave you Lord of the Flies by William Golding, a novel in which an aeroplane carrying a party of schoolboys crashes on a desert island. The boys try to establish democracy, but the group quickly descends into savagery. So what did you make of it?
Here we go. The waves lapped the island and added to the gentle hum of the forest. A boy danced through the vines. He was tall, with glasses, grey hair, a nondescript face and a funny top lip. Hey, wait for me, shouted a breathless fat boy. What's your name? My name's John. What do they call you? Kenneth. That's not a good name. Have you got a nickname? Oh, I don't care what they call me, said Kenneth, as long as it's not what they used to call me at school. What was that? Piggy. They used to call me Piggy. Piggy, 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 chanted John. Hey, have you noticed? We're all alone. You know what that means? No grown-ups. We're in charge. Just then a group of boys appeared. Hello, who's in charge here? Said a lad called Redwood. Well, no one, said John. Right then, I'll be leader, said Redwood. No, we should put it to the vote, said Piggy. What we need to do is build a fire and attract attention and get rescued, said John. Right, said Redwood. I should be leader. I say this island is our island and we must defend our sovereignty and not let any Johnny foreigners come in from other places like Brussels. We want to stay here on our island. We'll hunt pigs or those cows that we saw, you know, the ones that couldn't walk properly and were pretended to be sheep. Some of the smaller children cheered. Before long, all the smaller children would be called Littlans, though in private, John called them bastards. John, said Piggy, what do you think about us being here isolated? John knew he must win them over with a firm, resolute idea. Wait and see. Anyway, then the plot progresses, and they sort of get frightened by demons and ghosts and things like that, and they take up hunting and they cover themselves in war paint and they accept money for questions and things like that. And this is the end. This is finally when they run into their rescuers. "Who's in charge here?" said the naval officer. "I'm still here," said Johnny, stepping forward. Redwood, covered in war paint and naked but for his spear, brackets, which is quite a horrible image, close brackets, stepped forward to protest and then slunk back. The naval officer looked kindly at him. "I'm sorry, sonny. We're just checking up that none of you escaped."
And now imagine that soap powder is literature and we're trying to sell it to you. Listen to these evocative sound slithers and guess which book we're advertising. Miles and Dilly.
The dead heart of the countryside collides with the cramped streets of London. What terrible secret connects the lonely death of a lawyer's clerk, the fears of a society beauty, and the hopes of three young people on the threshold of life? The law. And a case that stretches back beyond living memory.
Deposition number 7483.
A case that drags its victims through degradation, death, and disfiguring disease.
I'm afraid it's smallpox.
Ooh.
Until the final secret is uncovered.
Mother!
Any ideas?
I can't... It's such a long time since I read it, but I think... Well, the lawyer's thing is, it seems to be a giveaway. Is it the Jarndyce v. Jarndyce?
Mm.
It's Bleak House by Charles Dickens.
It certainly is. Yeah, Roger Mack, try this one then.
When the world is collapsing around your ears, you just have to find your own way. The course of true love may have its downs.
Sorry, darling, it's all off.
And its ups.
Darling, it's on again.
You just have to take each day as it comes.
Hey, how too ill make you.
Because this time next week, it could all be over.
There you go, then.
Well, I don't think I want to read it. So we've got...
20s.
Yeah, a bit of jazz. Bit of jazz, and the world is collapsing all around us.
Yeah. Something like Scottish Gerald or Evelyn Waugh.
Well, you're getting close there, Roger, I think.
With your Evelyn Waugh.
Evelyn Waugh.
Oh, I thought Evelyn
Waugh. Oh, right, so it's up and down with Evelyn Waugh.
Oh, Vile Bodies.
Vile Bodies.
Vile Bodies from the front row.
Front row says Vile Bodies.
He kept pointing at us.
Vile Bodies. Because it starts with a storm at sea, then it's the storm at sea.
That's right.
And you get a bit of jazz, and there was a girl on the boat called Chastity. And right at the end, the hero, who's got three names, somebody Symes, ends up on the great battlefield and meets a drunken nurse who turns out to be her from the boat.
Is her name still Chastity?
Yes.
Lovely.
So it's time now to skip to the changing rooms and slip into some creased white shorts and dirty plimsolls. We're going to play Pirates in the Gym and jump from horse to donkey. Yes, it's jumping the plot. Characters from one novel jump into the plot of another, and our panellists have to imagine what happens next. So, Dilly, who jumped into which plot for you?
Well, Delilah, who everybody will, I hope, remember from the Old Testament, who'd done for Samson. She was the sultry temptress. She enters the plot of Little Women. And she meets Josephine March, or Jo, as she's known, at the hairdresser's. Now, Jo is the spirited second sister in Little Women. She's always trying to think up new ways to supplement the family's pitiful income. And so here we have her at the hairdresser's, and I've introduced two characters called the receptionist and Kirsty, who don't come from any novel I've ever read, but I just put them in because I wanted to hear Roger and Mark's dulcet tones.
Good morning. How can we help you?
I have an appointment with Delilah.
Name?
Joe March.
Right. Was it just a cut and colour or the full trichology consultation?
Oh, just a cut, actually.
Be it on your own head. Delilah, your 2 o'clock's here. Kirsty will take your coat and give you a gown.
Thanks.
Hello, I'm Kirsty. You having your hair done for something special?
No, I've just come for a cut.
I thought so. Right, you sit here. Would you like to look through some glasses? Oh, here comes Delilah now.
Hello. And what can we do for you today?
I want to cut my incredibly long, silky, chestnut brown hair and sell it.
Why?
Because the money will help to buy much-needed medicines for my angelic and incredibly musical sister, Beth, who's wasting away from something vague and romantic at home. Papa's away at the war, you see, and we're very poor. Yes, sirree, Bob.
Don't mention the word Bob. Bob, Bob, Bob. That's all I hear these days. Well, I hate to say it, but short is not gonna suit you. With that jawline, you should go for something softer, wispier. Oh, my God, who cut your hair last time?
My mother.
I thought as much. Look at the split ends.
Gosh, I'm so sorry.
I should think so. Well, I suppose you read about me in Hello magazine. Ever since the article, I am inundated. Everybody, they want the Samson cut. So, back to you. What we do with these problem locks?
I just gotta sell my hair. I must do something to help my family.
Listen, the bottom is fallen out of the hair market. Most I can give you 50 cents.
Why, Delilah?
Tiger economy. Wig makers are inundated with cheap hair from the Far East.
My, Delilah.
It's true. So, there's nothing else you can do to turn a buck?
Well, I really want to be a writer someday. I tried selling some of my short stories, but no luck so far. Forgive me, Delilah, I just couldn't take any more.
Listen, you want to get something to write about first? Girl from a sheltered background like you, she got nothing to say to the readers of Cosmopolitan. You want to live a little, earn some decent money in the meantime. So do what I did, become an exotic dancer.
Oh, I don't think Mommy would like me to do anything like that.
Hey, I took you for an independent sort of girl.
Well,
Listen, I still got some contacts in the Middle East. I wasn't just your average belly dancer, you know. I used to be a temptress until I could no longer do the splits.
A temptress? Golly gosh.
Yes, golly gosh indeed. How do you think I met Samson?
He was a client in the club?
Yep. He fell in love with me after seeing me do my trick with the ping pong balls.
You can do the trick with a ping pong ball?
Uh-huh. I can get them right across the room.
Well, I am impressed. I can see it would certainly pep up my writing if I had authentic experience of life as a couch dancer in the opium dens of Istanbul.
Not Constantinople.
Yes, Istanbul.
Not Constantinople.
Yes, Istanbul.
Not Constantinople.
Yes! By golly, it would make me at least the equal of Colette, Maya Angelou, Lisa Saint-Aubin de Turan. They'd have to look to their laurels. As for Jane Asher, hey, I'm doing the wrong accent.
Never mind.
Sorry. Yes, by golly, it would make me at least the equal of Colette.
Now you're talking. So will you do it or not?
Sign me up, Delilah. I'm going to twirl my passes with the best of them.
That's my girl. Kirsty, take Miss March to the backwash. She gonna go blonde.
And Roger, who's bunking plot for you?
Well, it's just William. Interrupts The Catcher and The Rye, the plot of Member Holden Caulfield, who will, with the rebel, or more of a would-be rebel, wasn't it? I think that's why I always liked him. He just wasn't as bad as he would like to have been. I remember this one afternoon. It was Saturday and I was sitting out on the porch. I'd been playing checkers with Jane and things were really shaping up. I just knew that pretty soon we'd end up kissing. When all of a sudden this booze hound her mother was married to came on the porch and, well, anyway, things didn't quite turn out as planned. So, boy, I felt miserable. I felt depressed. You can't imagine. Thought maybe I'd get on my bike and go round to Bobby's house, take our lunches and guns and ride over to Lake Sedabigo and shoot something. when suddenly onto the porch walked this strange guy. I mean weird.
Hello, my name is William.
Oh, yes, I said.
Yes, just William. Would you like to have a go with my catapult?
No, I said. Would you like a cigarette?
Gosh, no. What would Daddy say?
I couldn't believe this guy. Was he from outer space, I wondered? Where are you from, I said.
England, actually.
That would explain it.
I'm stopping with my people in the house across the field, sort of a holiday thing. You must be Holden Caulfield.
How the hell did you know that?
I was warned about you, told to keep well away from you.
So why didn't you?
Well, I'm a bit of a tinker, actually. Always getting into scrapes at home, so I thought, well, what the dickens? If we chummed up, sort of formed a club together, we could have all sorts of japes and adventures.
I think not, you limey crumbcake. It was then that I noticed the girl. Who's the dame hiding behind the hedge?
She's only a girl.
I can see that.
She sort of follows me around all the time. Girls are soppy, aren't they?
Hey, babe, come up here, tell us your name.
Violet Elizabeth, actually.
Nice name. Nice legs, too, I thought. Take off the glasses, undo the pigtails, remove the dental brace, and hey, that blouse has bulges in all the right places.
William's parents gave us strict instructions not to talk to you, Holden Caulfield.
Tell you what, then. Why doesn't William the Fink go back to his people and tell them that Violet Elizabeth is with Grandma Moses learning how to bake pumpkin pie?
I say, wouldn't that be telling rather a large fib?
I reached down and picked up the gun. Now beat it, you grey woolen weirdo. He did just that. I turned to the girl. She was looking at me kind of warmly.
Did I hear you say that you had cigarettes?
Sure. You want one?
There's always a first time.
I got some bourbon, too, if you want to try some.
Ooh, there's always a first time.
Hey, you're kind of cute.
Are your parents home?
She asked suddenly. No, I said.
In that case, why don't we cut out the foreplay and get straight into the bedroom and do it?
I gulped. Well, there's always a first time.
And now let's scour the shelves for a pity book cover, flip to the back and read the blurb. In this round, our teams have been given classic literary texts for which they have to write a blockbuster blurb that'll divert a browser in the blacklist section of train station bookstores. So, Dilly, your blockbuster's Kennedy's Latin Primer, the Latin textbook that everybody read at school if they did Latin.
Kennedy's Latin Primer, that's right. This is the blurb on the back. Amo, amas, amat. The Romans, in a thousand ways different, love could express. Amamus, amatis, amant. Truly, Latin language of passion was. Mensa, subject. Mensa, word same is, but word different is, because vocative is. O, table. Only Romans' tables addressed. Yet, suddenly, after hundreds of years of inascendant being, Latin from use general past, and mystery scholars even today baffles. Why? By barbarians ignorant off it killed was? If Caesar had some jam for tea, anyone a bugger did give. Public writers and, for prepositions did yearn. Or perhaps the populous verb at end of sentence of putting finally tire. Book of Kennedy fascinating, you how will show. Latin declined because the Romans to decline declined. Discover, O reader. Instead to drink they turned. Hic, hic, hoc. Yes, even their hiccups declined were. Latin, an insight fascinating into a language as a doormat dead.
And Marx got Das Kapital, Karl Marx's seminal political work.
Read the book that simply everyone says is unputdownable. The workers are dripping in labour-induced sweat. Bound by commodity fetishism, they have simply nothing to lose but their chains. A head-on collision with the ruling class is not just inevitable, it's historically inevitable. And when historical materialism is involved, you just know someone's going to get it right in the dialectics. Written by the man who put the com into communists, this book isn't just value for money, it's surplus value for profit. Read this book and find out why the publishers should be hung next to the aristos and the priests. Now also available in stunning action-packed CD-ROM game format.
So, Miles, you've got A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking, the book that explains everything about time you need to know and much more.
Okay, Brief History of Time. Time, perhaps the greatest news magazine ever published. Every week for as long as man can remember, it's been there on the bookstall. Unbought, unread, unnoticed. Where did it come from? What are its origins in the murky mists of prehistory? Was it created by design, brought forth by a Big Bang? Why does Time think that God is an American? Why have we never heard of any of the famous American people featured on the front cover of Time? And who first thought of the great slogan for the magazine? A stitch in time stops the pages falling out. Now at last you can find out everything in A Brief History of Time.
And Roger, you've got The Second Sex, Simone de Beauvoir's classic feminist text.
Yes, the Simone de Beauvoir, the existentialist and friend of Jean-Paul Sartre, it's her book, The Second Sex. Are women different from men? Non, 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 argues Simone de Beauvoir in her book about women, for women, by a woman who, being a woman, understands women. An existentialist philosophical study that comes bound in a choice of three colours to match your outfit. Pink, navy blue, and a rather nice creamy beige.
And to finish off, I'd like our gang to think up lines that fictional characters are least likely to say.
The Ancient Mariner. He says, do you know the one about the Englishman, the Irishman, and the Scotsman?
I'll go back to Mr. Hyde, he of Dr. Jekyll's poem. Mr. Hyde, I'm just going to slip into someone more comfortable.
Mr. Bumble in Oliver Twist, remember? Mr. Bumble, the beetle. More? More? Of course you can have some more. But make sure you leave plenty of room for your fried eggs, sausage, bacon, beans and black buns.
I've got General George Custer. Unless they're pizza delivery Indians, we're in big trouble.
I've got the cat and the fiddle saying, I'm afraid the cow has just jumped over the moon and has had to be put down.
I've also got Frankenstein here. And Frankenstein, least like to say, it's the Avon lady, it's the Avon lady.
Any more?
That's it, mate.
Okay, we've run out now.
All right. Well, it's time to finish now, so here's my poem about the panel. Off go the panel, see the panel run. Oh, the happy panel have had a lot of fun. Off go the panel, they look rather pooped. Gone to hibernate, till the next time we do, booked. So, it just remains for me to thank Mark Thomas, Roger McGough, Miles Kington and Dilly Keane. Was researched by Kate Withers, devised and produced in Bristol by Mark Yobst, and presented by me, Ian McMillan. Goodbye.